Welcome back to Beta. I'm Doug Gordon. In 1986, Run-DMC were rap superstars, while Aerosmith was a rock band on its last legs. But when the two groups teamed up to record a mashup of Aerosmith's Walk This Way, they changed the course of music history. The Washington Post's Jeff Edgers documents the saga in his book, Walk This Way. Aerosmith recorded the original version of the song in 1975. The music, anyway. The band had not written the lyrics yet.
So they walk around that whole day, and for some reason they went and they saw Young Frankenstein, the Mel Brooks movie.
Yes.
And if you remember that scene, Igor, you know, is meets Dr. Frankenstein, or I don't know how you pronounce
yeah,
it anymore.
Yeah, Frankenstein,
but
that's
he,
right.
He met him and he said, walk this way. And he, you know, is all hunched over, and of course, I don't know if that's a PC joke anymore, but then Dr. Frankenstein hunches over. And so when they got back in the studio, they thought that was hilarious, and that became the chorus.
Yeah.
The song itself is really, it's almost like a pre-rap rap. I mean, it's like, it's got the rhythms of like a hip-hop song in some weird way, the way Steven Tyler does it.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. So who came up with this idea to have Run-DMC and Aerosmith get together to record a version of Aerosmith's hit Walk This Way 11 years after it was originally released?
Well, it's not totally possible to know exactly who, but my reporting tells me that it's probably a combination of three people who are friends and talking at the same time. The person who gets credited the most is Rick Rubin, you know, the super producer who produced the record. But Rick Rubin was also talking to Sue Cummings, who is an editor at Spin Magazine, and she was talking to a guy named Tim Summer, who is a friend of Rick Rubin's from NYU. And I think it was one of those conversations where, like, Rick Rubin had an idea that melding rock and rap was going to be a good idea. Somebody in the mix said, well, why don't you get the guys from Aerosmith, which Rick Rubin, I think, thought sounded crazy. He loved Aerosmith from the 70s, and they were heroes to him. And since nobody had done this before, it didn't sound like he'd be able to get Aerosmith. He was like, you know, Tyler and Perry won't do that.
Yeah. Now, Rick Rubin had this kind of punk rock background. He'd been in a punk band called The Pricks, who had played Max's Kansas City in New York City, and they'd been thrown out for breaking furniture. So what was it about hip-hop that Rubin found so intriguing?
Well, I asked him that because I thought, what makes a guy who loves, you know, heavy metal and Aerosmith and those groups and then has a band that's like Flipper, basically, what makes you go and suddenly get into hip hop? And his feeling was that he felt like there was a ceiling already for what you could do in punk or hardcore. And he didn't feel like there was a ceiling creatively and also, you know, popularity-wise, of what you could get done in hip-hop or rap. And so that's what intrigued him, the idea of, like, pushing against that boundary of something new.
So who pitched this idea of rapping over Aerosmith's Walk This Way to Run-DMC?
Well, Rick Rubin came in the studio one day, and what's important is that this beat, the Walk This Way beat, boom, ch, boom, boom, ch, that beat had been used for years in hip-hop. You know, I talked to Grandmaster Flash, and he described lifting a record up and looking at how narrow the grooves were in a store and deciding whether that was a record he could use as a sample. And I found on YouTube, the oldest found recorded sample of Walk This Way was from 1978.
Wow.
It's not really a sample. You know, Grandmaster Flash had it on a turntable and just cut to it. But the thing that's important is that nobody in hip-hop used the song to the point that the lyrics came in. So, like, when Steven Tyler started singing, that song was done. And you were a bad DJ if you allowed it to get to that point. So one day, Rick Rubin walks in the studio, and he sees Run and D there, and he says, what are you doing? And they're like, oh, we're just working on a song. And they had Walk This Way, the beat, on the turntables. And they were doing what they wanted to do. They had the beat, and they were going to do, like, we're Run-DMC, it's a place to be, I went to St. John's. You know, they were going to do their own rap over the beat. And Rick Rubin said, you know, that's Aerosmith, right? And they're like, who? They didn't actually even know it was Aerosmith, because the way the DJs did it is they took a record and they would scratch out the song title because they didn't want people to steal their beat. So what they knew was, hey, this is number four, Toys in the Attic. And Rick Rubin, you know, again, it's 1986, so we don't have Genius or Google or whatever. he tells the guys, go listen to this song, and he gives them a notepad, and he gives them the record, and he has them go to Daryl's basement.
Mm-hmm.
And DMC and Run sit there and transcribe it.
Yeah, so what did Daryl McDaniels and Run think of Walk This Way the first time they actually heard the lyrics?
When they heard it for the first time, what they said was, this is hillbilly bull, bleep. That's what they thought.
Great
they
bleep.
They hated it. They hated the fact that this beat that was beloved had all this scraggly white guys singing stuff. They hated it.
Yeah, so they wanted to write their own lyrics? Did they want to rewrite their own lyrics?
They just wanted to do what they normally did, which is mm-hmm. get a beat and then do their own rhymes over that beat. You know, that's how all the great beats were used, whether it was, you know, like Billy Squier's The Big Beat or Walk This Way. That's how they were used to doing it. Bear in mind, it's like, again, to skip ahead, today, you know, Kanye and Paul McCartney and, I mean, everybody collaborates. There's yeah. nobody who doesn't collaborate. But before Walk This Way, there was no such thing. You just wouldn't have two rock guys and two rap guys going into the studio and doing something together. Just think about it. I mean, you can't come up with another example when you try to think of it because it didn't exist.
Who convinced Run and Daryl to do this?
I think part of it is that Jam Master Jay was like that silent and also not so silent leader.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always in the studio with Rick Rubin, listening, watching. And I think he knew that they were going to have to come in. And also, it wasn't like they were like given an ultimatum. They were just like told, hey, get down here and do this. You know, they were kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they came in and, you know, it was like going into the studio. They brought some, you know, some Big Macs. They sat in the corner. It wasn't like a formalized thing, but basically Jam Master Jay yelled at them.
Mm. Okay, so who pitched, let's look at the other side of the equation, who pitched this collaboration idea to Aerosmith lead singer Steve Tyler and lead guitarist Joe Perry?
It went from Rick Rubin talking to John Kolodner, who was the superstar A&R guy at Geffen Records and had signed Aerosmith and had been very upset because Aerosmith had been in disarray. Joe Perry had quit the band for mm-hmm. 5 years. He had come back, and they had produced a comeback record, quote-unquote, called Done With Mirrors. Came out in 1985, and it had not done well. So Kolodner was like sort of at his wit's end, but he said, you know, why not? And then he called Tim Collins, who was Aerosmith's manager at the time, and Collins went to Aerosmith. And it's really hard to know now exactly how they responded, but, you know, I've watched this video of Aerosmith getting interviewed at the time, and it's clear to me that they don't really know what they're getting into.
Yeah, we've heard them. We've heard them on the radio before, yeah.
Yeah, and I like their style because there's a lot of electric guitar in it, you know. And
finally.
Yeah, and it caught my ear. So when I found out about this, I was like, you know, real excited. You can tell.
You know, like you can tell that they don't actually know each other. There are other things that are going on that are so fascinating. You're watching Jam Master Jay at his turntables, and he's got two copies of Toys in the Attic, one on each turntable, and Tyler and Perry are standing over him, and he's cutting from the beat on one to the beat on the other and then back. And what he's basically showing those guys is, hey, your song doesn't mean anything to me when you start singing, dude. And you can see Tyler and Perry just kind of like, I don't know what's going on in their brains, but I think at a certain point they're taking in and realizing these guys don't really like this song that much, you know?
Yeah.
So it's amazing to watch that. And then also just watching, you know, Run and D, a major thing that happens is they actually didn't record their final rap for that song that day, even though everybody thought they did, because they didn't take it seriously enough. And you can see them rapping with their little you know, crinkly yellow page of lyrics in front of them, and they're just goofing off, and they're saying things that are kind of profane at times,
yeah.
And they're not taking it seriously.
Surely it's y'all. Okay. This is it, y'all. Surely it's y'all. We make a record with Aerosmith, y'all.
The song was released on July 4th of 1986. How did the public and critics react?
Well, I mean, the public reacted by making it the biggest hit of Run DMC's career and the first crossover rap hit. And, you know, the reason really is, and that in itself isn't amazing. I mean, there were a lot of terrible hits at that time. I mean, Aha was riding high, right?
Yes, On Me.
But what's important is that it reached the public, because what happened is the song came into WBCN, which was the rock radio station in Boston, and a powerful rock radio station that other programmers followed. And they were a station that considered Aerosmith like their hometown band, you know, the Bad Boys of Boston.
Sure.
And so when that record came in, and it was a song they knew from the 70s, and the two lead guys of Aerosmith were on it, they put it on the air. And that was exceptional because rap was never played on rock radio. Once they did that, MTV then felt comfortable putting a Walk This Way video into regular programming hours, not like at 1 a.m., you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how that song then reached the mainstream.
As you say in your book, Aerosmith and Run DMC's collaboration on Walk This Way was more than a top 10 hit. It changed our culture. How did it change our culture?
The things that happened right after Walk This Way are clear and obvious. And it's not just in music where you had, you know, Public Enemy and Anthrax, or you had bad things like Limp Bizkit, you know? But you also had, basically, hip-hop became part of our culture, which it hadn't been before. So Yo MTV Raps emerges after that. On TV, you've got The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, you've got In Living Color, you've got Arsenio, and, you know, on that record, Raising Hell, it's the first hip-hop merchandising deal, which is My Adidas, and Adidas paying Run-DMC $1 million to market their sneakers. So that's what I'd say changes. And, you know, like, how far do you draw that out? I mean, do we say that, you know, a black president? I don't know, you know, but I'm saying that something changed. Hip-hop, which had been like a secret and on college radio, suddenly became the central way that our culture processes art and music.
You say that it's important to consider race as it relates not just to Walk This Way, but to Run DMC in general. What is it about race that we should be thinking about?
Well, my main thing is, you know, the people who set the stories and write history are the winners. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, this book is full of central characters who aren't that well known, but I'd argue were just as important, if not more important, than the characters we know. So Rick Rubin, who I hold nothing against, but Rick Rubin does LL Cool J's record and the third Run DMC record, and he's on the cover of the Village Voice called The King of Rap.
Yeah.
Larry Smith, who produced the first two Run DMC records, the Fat Boys, and Houdini's records, you know, in a 2-year period, he's like Phil Spector. I mean, he's got like multiple platinum records. You go on the street and, you know, or go to South by Southwest and ask 100 people who Larry Smith is, and I bet you 99 and a half wouldn't know, and the last one would say, was he in The Clash?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, yeah. The reality is Larry Smith was a pioneer. He created Run DMC's original sound, and, you know, the fact is Walk This Way is the most important Run DMC song, but it's certainly not the best one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sucker MCs, I would say, is a better song. Rockbox, which had an electric guitar on it that Larry Smith produced, is a more important song in some ways. So Larry Smith, or for example, someone like Grandmaster Caz, you know, who is an amazing, amazing central figure, the Cold Crush. Run DMC looked up to him endlessly. And Grandmaster Caz does hip-hop bus tours now, which is not, they're not bad, but you could pay $70 and go through New York on a bus with Grandmaster Caz as your guide.
In her New York Times review of your book, Baz Dreisinger asked the question, quote, "What does it say about American culture that for an African-American art form to receive its due, it had to not just seek white validation, but cloak itself in the trappings of whiteness?" End quote. What do you think the answer to this question is?
I would take a little issue with that only because I don't think that Walk This Way cloaked itself in whiteness. Mm. I think that there were two white guys contributing, but unlike, for example, Ice Ice Baby, and I admit it, Vanilla Ice is an easy target, but Walk This Way is an actual good song, and Run DMC is central to that song. And I'd argue that that song is better when it's sequenced in the actual record.
Mm.
So you got to ask yourself the question, And it's a super complicated question that I can't really answer. But the question is, you know, is it a bad thing that sometimes we embrace things based on the fact that that's who the programmers are giving us, you know? I mean, we're basically, the reason Walk This Way succeeded is because the programmers, the people in charge, decided to put it on the air. And, you know, there's a huge argument or debate going about whether MTV was racist, right? Because I've got people in the book saying their programming was racist. You know, they were racist in how they discriminated against black artists. What MTV would say is we weren't discriminating against black artists. We were discriminating against something that fell outside the format. Our format was rock music. So if you were Stevie Wonder, or you were Michael Jackson, or you were Aretha Franklin, or Marvin Gaye, or Billy Ocean, you fit inside that rubric. But if you were Grandmaster Flash, or the Fat Boys, or Run DMC, you didn't fit.
Yeah.
You know, Russell Simmons said an amazing thing to me. He said that the black record executives and the black publications were actually slower to embrace rap and hip hop than the white ones. He said, we got on, you know, Rolling Stone before we got on black publications. And he said that there was a feeling the African-American executives looked down on hip hop. They felt like it was not as cultured. And they embraced like Peebo Bryson and like, you know, rhythm and blues and soul music. And that was the battle there. So it's a really hard thing to figure out.
Jeff Edgers is the author of Walk This Way, Run DMC, Aerosmith, and the Song That Changed American Music Forever. You can find out more about Jeff and Walk This Way at WPR.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
You don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle.
Our technical and music director is Steve Gotcher.
He's freakish big and freakish strong and quicker than you'd expect for a man of that size.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
He's prettier than both my daughters. He's young. But he knows how to lead.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
There are few men of honor in the capital. You are one of them.